You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit is unumstossbar.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. He's fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
Let's do this!
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in Singapore for SBS World News. For decades, three generations of dictators in Pyongyang have amassed an arsenal of nuclear weapons at the expense of the North Korean people. Fear of those now viable rockets, as many as 60 of them, this week bought Kim Jong-un an historic handshake and a seat at the table with Donald Trump.
We have developed a very special bond, so people are going to be very impressed, people are going to be very happy, and we're going to take care of a very big and very dangerous problem for the world.
In a moment, we'll hear more from a triumphant US president who seems to have big plans for North Korea.
They have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? I said, boy, look at that. Wouldn't that make a great condo behind? And I explained, I said, you know, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there. Think of it from a real estate perspective. You have South Korea, you have China, and they own the land in the middle. How bad is that, right? It's great.
We'll also discuss the summit's much-hyped four-point agreement with Phil Robertson from Human Rights Watch.
To say that Kim Jong-un is a terrific guy and that the North Korean people love him just shows Donald Trump's complete ignorance of what the real situation is in North Korea. The reality is that the North Korean people don't love Kim Jong-un. They're afraid of him.
But first, here's James Elton Pym with a look at the week that was in Australian politics.
Thanks, Brett. Well, while the world paused to watch the landmark leaders' summit in Singapore this week, back at home, the Australian government was preparing a wide-ranging response to the Child Abuse Royal Commission. On October the 22nd this year, Malcolm Turnbull has promised he'll deliver a national apology to the child abuse survivors, victims and their families. But the response to the Royal Commission goes much further than that. The government says it accepts 104 of the Commission's 122 recommendations and will discuss the remaining 18 with the states and territories. It'll set up a new Office of Child Safety and, with Western Australia's last-minute signing, a national redress scheme offering survivors up to $150,000 each in compensation. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull paid tribute to the survivors who gave evidence to the Royal Commission, helping to expose the scale of abuse in churches, schools and youth groups around the country.
Crimes committed against you were validated in your evidence. You testified to them. You were heard and you were believed, and the wrongdoers have been brought to account.
One of the Commission's most controversial recommendations would force religious ministers to report crimes against children they hear in the confessional. The ACT has already created such a law, and the other states and territories have agreed to bring their laws into line, despite opposition from the Catholic Church. In other news, recent divisions within One Nation reached their long-anticipated conclusion this week. Senator Brian Burston has quit the party and will now sit as an independent, 2 weeks after party leader Pauline Hanson sacked him as her deputy and accused him of stabbing her in the back. The dispute was triggered when Senator Burston said he would vote against One Nation in favour of the government's company tax cuts. The government's leader in the Senate, Matthias Cormann, said he was pleased the senator would honour their old agreement.
It's obviously been very public. We appreciate the fact that Senator Burston has decided and has publicly announced that he will continue to support the government's plan.
And it wouldn't be a Canberra week without former Nationals leader Barnaby Joyce in the headlines. And there he was earlier in the week, despite still being away on leave. He was leaving a church in Armidale when he noticed a photographer snapping him from across the street. Mr. Joyce filmed the encounter on his phone, accusing the photographer of hiding in the bushes.
Keep following you around.
Yeah, why do you keep following us around with your cameras?
Well, it's our job.
But what's who do you work for?
How can you seriously come out of church and size someone up to punch them?
I didn't size you up to punch
Yes, you did.
No,
you put, you pulled your right hand back, and you were. If I hadn't actually walked away, you would have clubbed me.
That's great. Why do you do this?
Yeah, go back to your regular job as a bouncer.
What's your name, mate? What's your name?
Seriously.
What's your name? Why are you walking away? What's your name? What's your name, mate?
Seriously, that Barnaby, that's just ridiculous what you just did.
Mr. Joyce strongly denies that claim. Later in the week, the government indicated it was considering a new English test for all migrants who want to live in Australia permanently. There's already an exam for citizenship conducted in English, and many permanent residents are already tested, including skilled migrants and international students. But their partners and families are not tested, and nor are refugees who come through the humanitarian intake. Citizenship Minister Alan Tudge says the government wants to reverse what he says is an increase in the number of Australians with poor English.
What we are concerned about is that we have close to 1 million people now who don't speak the English language in Australia. Now, that's not in the interests of those individual migrants, but nor is it in the interests of social cohesion, because basically if we can't communicate with one another, it's very difficult to integrate.
The detail of the plan is yet to be revealed, but the government has repeatedly said they want to reattempt last year's failed citizenship reforms sometime this year.
For the first time in history, the leaders of North Korea and the United States have met face to face on neutral soil, shaking hands and exchanging pleasantries over prawn cocktails and ice cream, even showing off their respective armoured limousines to each other during a stroll around Singapore's exclusive Sentosa Island. Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump signing an aspirational four-point plan, setting out their mutual long-term ambitions, agreeing to establish new diplomatic relations, joining together to build a lasting and stable peace, working towards complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and recovering the remains of soldiers killed in the Korean War, including 43 Australians who remain missing in action.
These are of fallen heroes, and they're giving a commitment. They're starting it immediately to recover the remains. And I just went through how many people asked me about it. I was amazed, actually. So many people would ask me, is it possible? Is it possible? At that time, we had no relationship to Chairman Kim or to anybody else in North Korea. You know, it was a very closed society. So we're getting the remains back.
The world will see a major change, Kim Jong-un told the assembled reporters here in Singapore, both leaders appearing to enjoy the theatrics and sense of occasion. There were plenty of lights and cameras, but the big question now is, will there be any action? Of course, we've been here many times before. Previous agreements have collapsed, goodwill between the two countries quickly evaporating. However, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull believes there's reason to be optimistic.
Now, where will it lead? Will it result in the complete denuclearisation of the peninsula? Only time will tell, and the President's acknowledged that. But he is giving it, he's having a red-hot go at achieving denuclearisation on the Korean Peninsula, and you have to give him credit for that.
I spoke with Phil Robinson from Human Rights Watch here in Singapore just after the summit concluded. What do you make of Donald Trump's effusive praise of one of the world's most brutal dictators? What kind of message do you think that his words send to the North Korean people?
Well, it's absolutely unconscionable that Donald Trump heaps so much praise on Kim Jong-un. I mean, I can understand him wanting to talk about denuclearizing North Korea, but to say that Kim Jong-un is a terrific guy and that the North Korean people love him just shows Donald Trump's complete ignorance of what the real situation is in North Korea. The reality is that the North Korean people don't love Kim Jong-un. They're afraid of him, and they would all leave if they could. If you took down the barriers at the North Korea-China border and told the Chinese government to stop chasing North Korean defectors and sending them back, I expect you'd have hundreds of thousands of people leave within a matter of weeks.
We know that Kim Jong-un has murdered members of his own family. We know that all but one of the men who carried his father's coffin have been liquidated by the regime. Do you think that he's more oppressive than his father was? He has left North Korea. His visit here to Singapore is being reported in real time back at home. So he's obviously not concerned about being overthrown by his own military or people. Is this a leader who's emboldened by this dialogue with Donald Trump?
Well, I think you're onto something there. It's absolutely clear that Kim Jong-un is as repressive or worse than his father. We have seen him liquidate family members. We have seen him increase the pressure on defectors, people who have gone overseas to try to pressure their families to get them to come back. Just before he left, actually, he issued a new order to the state security services to go after North Koreans overseas talking about human rights as traitors. This is a man who has consolidated power in a very ruthless way, and he is going to try to ride that to decades of being in power. The key issue for him is that he's decided to open up markets at the local level in North Korea. And then how does he deal with the infusion of goods and services and the fact that people now have greater freedom to move around? Part of that, I think, is he wants to hold on to the incoming investment, and he wants to hold on to the economy and use it to bolster his power, not necessarily to empower the people.
Donald Trump says he raised human rights with Kim Jong-un. Do you believe him?
I have my doubts. Maybe there was something said in passing. But as we saw 6 months ago when Donald Trump gave a sort of stinging speech at the South Korean parliament about North Korea's human rights record, he's saying one thing then and said something completely different now, that, hey, it's a little bit rough, but, it's rough everywhere. What that means to me is that there's no stake on human rights issues in North Korea for Donald Trump. It's just a bargaining chip to get something else that he wants.
What do you think he should have said to Kim Jong-un about human rights?
What he should have said is, Kim Jong-un, if you want to be part of the international community, if you want to come in from the cold, you need to be practicing some basic human rights principles. You have to have some accountability. You can't send people to the gulags. You can't use forced labor all over the country. You can't force your students to toil half a day every day on joint projects that the government wants. You have to abide by a certain set of norms. And if you don't, then there's not a place for you at the table.
If human rights haven't been listed as one of these four aspirations for the relationship between the United States and North Korea, do you worry that it may never be, that it's too late down the track to start to talk about some of these trickier issues?
Well, we're worried about that. We're worried that because it's not on the agenda now, because it wasn't written down, the commitments that were made, if any, are not binding. And that ultimately, if other things come up that the United States wants, human right gets the short stick, gets pushed off the table once again. And that's why we wanted to have some mention in that communique about human rights. We wanted to have something that said, the two sides discussed human rights and agreed to discuss it further in a mutually agreed framework. That would have been sufficient to give us the leverage to continue the discussion. But right now, we're not nowhere near that.
And just finally, how do you think this summit and these four aspirations will be interpreted by the North Korean people?
Well, this will be spun as a huge victory for Kim Jong-un and the ruling Workers' Party of Korea. It will be told to the North Korean people that, we stood firm against this president and we gained a seat at the table. The reality is that a lot of people reading between the lines will see that the U.S. basically walked away from human rights and it walked away from a lot of other issues just because Kim Jong-un, developed nuclear weapons. The takeaway will be, hey, we did it, we won. And, all the things that happened when that money was being diverted to military weapons and missiles, like people not getting fed, children dying of starvation, it was all worth it. And that will be the sort of thing that the government will say, and the people will have no choice but to believe that or try to get overseas and run the gauntlet that Kim Jong-un has established to try to prevent people from doing that.
Phil Robertson there from Human Rights Watch. President Donald Trump declared the world can sleep soundly, tweeting, "There is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea." He spoke with reporters on Sentosa Island after Kim Jong-un had left the secure summit venue. Here are some of the highlights from his longest ever presidential press conference.
But we signed a very, very comprehensive document, and I believe he's going to live up to that document. In fact, when he lands, which is going to be shortly, I think that he will start that process right away. I do. Well, he is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it and run it tough. I don't say he was nice or I don't say anything about it. He ran it. Very few people at that age, you can take one out of 10,000 probably couldn't do it. Denuclearization, it takes a long time. Scientifically, you have to wait certain periods of time and a lot of things happen. But despite that, once you start the process, it means it's pretty much over. You can't use them. That's the good news. And that's going to start very, very soon. I believe that's going to start very soon. We will do it as fast as it can mechanically and physically be done. The war games are very expensive. We pay for a big majority of them. We fly in bombers from Guam. I said it when I first started. I said, where do the bombers come from? Guam. Nearby. I said, oh, great, nearby. Where's nearby? 6.5 hours. It's a very provocative situation. When I see that, and you have a country right next door. So under the circumstances that we're negotiating a very comprehensive, complete deal, I think it's inappropriate to be having war games. So number one, we save money a lot. We'll probably need another summit. We'll probably need, or meeting, we can use a different term, but we'll probably need another one. I will say this, we're much further along than I would have thought. I did not think we'd be here. I thought, and I've told people, I didn't want to build up people's hopes too much. I told people, I thought that this would be a successful meeting if we got along, we developed a relationship, and we could have maybe gotten to this point in 3 or 4 months from now. But it really happened very quickly.
An effusive President Donald Trump. The U.S. Secretary of State is now visiting Seoul and Beijing as regional players seek specific details about exactly how and when this wish list will come to fruition. Questions, frankly, we'd all like answered. The White House says we need to be patient. This summit was about extracting trust from Kim Jong-un, not immediate concessions. This could be the defining moment of Donald Trump's presidency and perhaps a defining moment in modern history. That's it for another week. I'm signing off, sunburnt, from a sweltering Singapore. It's been incredible to witness. Have a great weekend.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal nation, both past and present.
Tell us what you think. Rate this podcast on iTunes. It helps other people to find us.